Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Combined Federal Campaign recently wrapped up its annual campaign with a finale and awards ceremony event. It signifies another year of giving monetary pledges or volunteering for charitable causes. To get a sense of how much was given last year, we welcome back Vince McConey, co-chair of the Combined Federal Campaign of the National Capital Area. Vince, thank you so much for making the time for us again.
Eric, thank you. And to all of the listeners, we really appreciate your support of the Combined Federal Campaign. I have some good news to share. Across the nation of the Combined Federal Campaign, we raised about $68 million in monetary gifts and had over 81,000 hours of volunteer service registered and pledged by federal employees. So we're very excited about how the campaign went last year. Just so you know, we raised about the same amount of money, give or take, as we did last year. So we held steady. Here in the District, Maryland and Virginia, we had a phenomenal year. We raised $33 million. So if you look at the 68 and minus 33, it gives you a sense of how generous our employees are in the National Capital Region, because that's about half of the nation's total. And actually, also in our region, 45,475 volunteer hours were pledged to CFC charities by federal employees here in 2023. It's a little bit more than last year, give or take, but we're very, very excited with that. And this represents contributions by 25,000 employees in our region. So this is phenomenal. We'll have a huge impact on those organizations that are serving unmet needs in our communities.
Yeah, on those stats and milestones that you mentioned, what were some of the main causes or, you know, in speaking with those who donated their time or money that they were mostly passionate about ensuring that their help got to?
One of the things that I enjoy about our theme with the Combined Federal Campaign is it focuses on causes every week during the campaign. One week we may focus on global health, another week on environmental protection, military and veteran service. So what we try to do is really identify for federal employees that those 5,000 charities that are in the campaign, those 5,000 organizations represent a wide range of interests and causes that are of deep concern and care by federal employees. So during the campaign, we spend time going through those 14 broad categories and help inform employees about ways that they can get involved, not only during the fall, but that the CFC is always a resource list of organizations that are involved in causes that are most important to people.
Yeah, were there any particular famous events or disasters that the CFC wanted to make sure they were on top of? I can think of a couple off the top of my head, but I'll let you do that.
So we were very engaged in reminding individuals about the importance of responding to the devastating wildfires in Maui. And that happened at a time when it really hit in terms of campaign activity. But I can tell you right now, CFC charities are active and engaged in Baltimore in response to the collapse of the Key Bridge. That's a great thing about our contributions to CFC. They don't just end in the fall, and they don't just focus on one particular incident or tragedy or disaster or storm. The dollars that go to those charities work 24/7 year round, hitting whatever the most current needs are, which sort of sets the Combined Federal Campaign away from charity drives that you may get by email or through social media. The dollars that we provide through the CFC are flexible, so those nonprofits can figure out the best time to use those charitable contributions to make a deep impact on whatever is happening within the community that those charities serve, across the country for national incidents that may occur, or things that are happening around the globe.
Yeah, and that really does speak to the uniqueness of CFC setup, whereas, you know, it's not just a people see something on the news and they feel bad and they give one time. This is a thing that continues to go on and on, even though, you know, when there are these long slog efforts to recover, like in Maui and like we're going to see with the Key Bridge.
You're exactly right. Those are two really good examples of where we remain at the beginning steps of long-term recovery. One of the things I'm concerned about is all the workers whose lives are being impacted. In addition to those lives lost, there is just an entire set of community members that are going to be impacted by the Key Bridge incident that we're going to need to be working with for short, medium, and long term. And also, of course, our hearts go out to those workers that lost their lives. And there are many organizations that are standing ready to work with the families to support them in this time, both those who have perhaps seen their jobs put on hold and those who lost their lives and the families of those folks. It takes a community to solve community issues. And these are two examples of where the CFC and those organizations in the CFC will have a big impact.
We're speaking with Vince McCone. He's the chairperson of the local federal coordinating committee of the National Capital Region, but you divulged to me that that may not be the case. Let's talk 2024. What's on the docket for the combined federal campaign next year?
So, you know, sometimes it helps when you work with your neighbors to solve problems, building bridges to your neighbors to deal with profoundly important issues. And what we found is we have two extraordinarily strong combined federal campaign activities, one in Chesapeake Bay, Baltimore, and one here in Washington, D.C. And Baltimore and D.C. and our metro areas were neighbors. So we are going to combine our efforts, combine our energy, combine our staff, combine our leadership, and we hope to have the largest combined federal campaign and a much more significant outreach in the Mid-Atlantic with a brand new marketed CFC called the Mid-Atlantic Area Combined Federal Campaign. We're combining the leadership of the two local federal coordinating committees, which is our fancy way of saying the board of directors, and really looking at how we can get a better bang for the investment we have with the staff and the loaned executives and the volunteers who make the CFC happen. We are very excited about this. We've worked all year on pulling together a framework that we're going to start when our campaign kicks off this fall. So we're very excited about that. We're very excited for the synergies. And we're really excited about how we can communicate impact to employees. Because, of course, Baltimore and D.C., there's no clear dividing line. We have family, friends, relatives, and loved ones, colleagues throughout this entire metropolitan area. And the Combined Federal Campaign is going to start speaking with one voice to the needs that we can meet through our efforts across the Mid-Atlantic region.
Yeah, as somebody who lives equidistant between D.C. and Baltimore, I can attest that you do feel a pull towards both cities. How did that all come together? Was it you're stepping on each other's toes a little, or are you just trying to support each other? I know that this is all for charity, so there's not a rivalry or anything there.
We've worked together for a few years, and we've actually talked about how if we combined efforts, we could probably have a bigger impact. And so we worked with OPM to figure out how to make that happen. And now that we figured out a good way, we're going to implement it. Everyone is supportive of this, and we think it's just going to be an incredible add value to what we do. Now, to employees, you know, they're not going to see some of the stuff that we're doing. It's not going to be obvious to them, which is exactly what we want. But behind the scenes, we're going to be doing everything we can to make sure that employees have an informed opportunity to contribute.
And for those interested who are not involved yet, how can they do so, Vince?
Eric, can I leave everyone with 2 points? National Volunteer Week is coming up. So those of you who have pledged, not pledged volunteer hours, go ahead and find time during National Volunteer Week to get involved in your community. 2, if you're a new federal employee, you don't need to wait till fall. You can contribute now. Go to our website, see what information might be on Eric's website, and make sure that you get involved.
Vince McCone is with the Combined Federal Campaign. Vince, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you. And again, thanks to your listeners for their support.
You can find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com, along with some more information on how to get involved with all that good stuff that Vince was talking about. And you can also subscribe to The Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there taking notes on the meeting and said, go ahead and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.